San Antonio, Texas. Thomas Booker on Bondi Tunes International.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. And we welcome our listeners on FM in Canberra, Australia, and the capital, also the capital of New Zealand, Wellington. Welcome, guys. I'm Henry in Sydney on Bondi Beach, and I'm joined by Thomas Booker, who is our North America correspondent, one of three. And he joins me now from Texas.
Yeehaw!
San Antonio de Bayar, to be precise. Thomas, you know, back in the 80s, there was this little TV show that was based in Dallas, Texas, and it would have to be called Dallas. You're from Texas. Was it popular in Texas itself? Very popular around the world.
There is a certain portion of the population of Texas that responds favorably to the cliches of Texas.
Yes.
Which are, you know, are complete. I mean, they're completely bogus. Yeah, Dallas was an interesting soap opera. The problem is it was this alleged super rich family. I guess I can't remember if they made their millions off oil or if it was cattle ranching.
It was oil.
Yeah, okay. So that's the other cliche.
Yeah.
I think it was oil.
Yeah.
But
it's like you remember the Hillbillies.
Yeah,
what was it called?
Like rich.
What were they called? What was the name? The something Hillbillies? I don't know.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
That's it, the Beverly Hillbillies.
That was
a crazy show as well.
Well, it was... Okay, there's a problem with the Beverly Hillbillies. Matter of fact, that's another caricature, and we could go into that at length if you want to, but it has to do with a very insulting... It goes a long way back to Virginia and Kentucky, and... the feud that broke out between the Hatfields and McCoys, which was actually a feud of land versus mining access versus railroad. It was a very complicated clash between two families that wound up being portrayed. Matter of fact, I think the federal government, the National Guard, had to intervene at one point when this. But this is back around the turn of the last, you know, I was the late 18th century to early 19th century where there was the fuming and spewing. Sure. But a reporter for, I think it was the New York Herald Tribune, one of the newspapers up in New York, went down and tried to do a background story on the feud. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who came back. He actually invented most of the narrative. And he came back with this really atrocious characterization of backwoods, hillbilly, you know, superstitious, old-timey. And so he did the whole caricature of what they call hillbillies now.
Yes.
And and so there's something really sad about it, that to think that somebody would get rich in Virginia on finding an oil well, and the family gets wealthy, and they decide to move to California, which is, well, you know.
And that's what it was based on, the Beverly Hillbillies. It was really kind of uncool, wasn't it? Because they were depicted as basically rednecks,
It was insulting, but then the whole plot of it was everybody tried to use them to manipulate them, and it always wound up being Jethro or somebody else would see through it, and he had good old mountain wisdom and good sense. And so that was the basic plot of it, is that people would try to pull something off on him. But you know, this whole absurd thing about moving in a tin Lizzie, an old Model T, across the nation to California, live in a mansion in Beverly Hills, and still wear their hillbilly outfits and cook outside and all this other.
It was a bit of fun, wasn't it?
It was a bit of fun, but it was also really grotesque, horrible television.
Yes, of course. Now, let's get back to Dallas for a second. When the whole meme of who shot JR came out, they got the highest ratings of any TV evening show in the world, and everyone around the world in about 100 countries were asking who shot JR. Did you care about that? Because I was a teenager at the time, and I honestly couldn't give a fling.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't watch one episode. I was because basically all it was a soap opera, and it was silly. And I was a kid, a very young kid in the early 60s. I had to live in Dallas for 2 years, and I didn't really have much of a fondness. Come to think of it, Dallas is a dry county. And I think.
Really?
Yeah. And so in honor of, I mean, I need to, that already makes me wanting one. So hang on a second. There you go.
Oh, thank you so much. A beer comes across the planet 13,500 miles in less, 0.4 of a second. Thank you so much, Thomas. It's very hot here.
A miracle of the internet. Yes.
A beer is just what I need. Mm. Just posted on social media a picture of an old radiogram, which I found very interesting, and I believe it was from your brother's attic. And does it have when does it date back to, and does it have valves and all that sort of stuff?
Oh, I think it probably would date back to the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, and yes, it did have valves, otherwise known as tubes. And
that's right, yeah. They used to call television the tube, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And it was a tube. And as a matter of fact, I was joking with people about how when we were growing up as kids, we developed patience because we had everything we turned on had to take 30 seconds to warm up.
Radios, even radios. Yeah.
Yeah, we had tube radios that we listened to, and we had a radio tube or a tube operated amplifier for our record player. Yes, goes, I can send you photos of the oldies.
Yes, I was really intrigued by the picture that you put on social media of that old radiogram. And by the way, dear listeners, you know, this is probably where the name YouTube came from. What do you reckon, Thomas?
YouTube was supposed to reference the television tube, and it was supposed to be kind of a actually, you're right. At the time, people computers were still CRTs. Cathode ray tubes. So those are all the computer monitors and everything were glowing.
Really? I didn't know that. Oh.
Well, yeah. I mean, back when you were, you had the big, that's why you had the big box of with the screen on it.
Yes, of course.
And that was all.
No flat screens, eh?
No flat screens. No, they hadn't come around yet. So that's how they got the idea to call it YouTube.
Wow. Well, are you going to do anything with this old radiogram?
Oh, I just couldn't throw it away. I couldn't, I'm kind of like keeping historic items and artifacts, and I don't necessarily want to keep them for myself, but you know, I'd like to save them that maybe somebody would appreciate them and want them. So I do have a lot of artifacts going all the way back to family and, the 40s and the late 30s and all kinds of stuff lying around.
I love all that stuff. I really do.
Yeah. It's interesting to touch something that was, you know, that somebody was wearing or using or something, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. It is kind of a cool feeling. But this thing, I mean, I would really wish I could have been a kid in the early 60s maybe and had this around, because I did play with old tube-operated shortwave radios. And I did on winter's
day. So did I. I used to listen to Radio Moscow. This was the 1970s.
Oh, yeah, the international, yes. Oh, God.
And shortwave was fantastic. And just to explain to anyone who doesn't know, of course, you know, there was long wave, and there was medium wave, which is also AM, amplitude modulation. And then there was short wave. Now, medium wave was very commercial, obviously, up to the early 80s when frequency modulation came in, known as FM. But short wave and you know, AM or, you know, medium wave was used commercially. I think it was from 88 to 107. On the dial.
88 to 107. That's the 88 to 108.
Oh, sorry, that's FM. Pardon me.
Yes.
Don't ask me what the AM is. But the thing about shortwave was it could go much longer distances.
Well, yes. And remember, you got to remember back in the 30s, we had our Columbia Broadcasting System was in effect. It was radio. I don't know if you remember. Familiar name from that era, Edward R. Murrow.
No.
Okay, well, he was a very prominent announcer, but he had a very stern, authoritative voice. And he was working in cahoots with a few other people who actually went and when they were in Europe watching the rise of the Nazis, and they actually wired up a radio network, a shortwave radio network, so they could follow. They covered the marches in Berlin, and I think they covered, there was actually there somebody was on scene when they had the book burning, and they actually had somebody race ahead to be in Austria for the Anschluss when the Austrians invited Hitler to come in and unite with Germany. And then later on, of course, there was the famous This Is London, where they
said, "This is London."
London, and that was Edward R. Murrow, and he was usually on rooftops with a radio set describing the Blitz as it happened. And you can actually hear the air raid sirens and the guns going off and bombs dropping and all of that. And he was standing there confidently and sternly narrating his way all through it. And all of that was done by shortwave.
Yes.
And then,
Yes.
I don't know. Do you remember if you were listening to a shortwave radio that you would tune some stations that would have the weird kind of airplane kind of noise?
Indeed. Look, I was obsessed with tearing little transistor radios apart. Of course, transistor radios came in the late 60s in Ireland, maybe earlier in the US. But I was obsessed with this. I was obsessed with working on radio. I was also obsessed. And what I do, if you talk about the FM band or the AM band, I would extend the bands physically so that I would pick up police. I'd pick up airport conversations, people taxiing.
Prince Charles.
anything. It was just great, just breaking all the rules.
We had, when I was at the electronics school, and we had this old TV set speaking, it was a cranky old thing, and it was Dumont. And we used to have a long time ago a Dumont broadcasting system that didn't last very long. But this was a Dumont television. It was tube-powered, and it didn't have the tints on the channel. In other words, it was a smooth tuning, so you would have to tune in a station, and you would just sort of smoothly dial it until you picked it up, and you tweaked it back and forth until you got a good signal. But I also took it and tuned it all the way up, and I was able to hear cell phone conversations.
Really? So that was quite recently by comparison to me doing it in the 70s.
This was late 70s.
From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International.
If you've just joined us, I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, where it's extremely hot, but I've got a beer which has been sent to me by Thomas Booker, who is in Texas. Thomas, I want to talk about your time in Japan, because in 1985 you went to Japan, and you did mention that the beer was particularly good, and I've heard this from a friend of mine who goes there every year.
Yes, Sapporo and Asahi, and they had a few other brands that were nice. And I actually went and actually got to sit in an actual sushi bar and eat real sushi, which was really fun. And the beer helped, because some of the stuff you really needed to wash down. But it was pleasant to be there, and actually, you know, just I was there and hanging, and I was, you know, making friends, and
You were sorry to interrupt you. You were there for work, weren't you? What were you doing?
Yes. It was we were having a collaborative effort with the University of Tokyo, and they had I don't know if it still exists or not. It's the Institute for Space and Astronautical Sciences. Mm-hmm. Astronomical Sciences. And we were there working with them on the hardware that was going to fly on a space shuttle mission. It was called CPAC, Space Experiments with Particle Accelerator. And it was kind of a cool setup. It was what it was designed to do was to accelerate electrons and fire them into away from the Earth, and also fire them into the upper atmosphere of the Earth to simulate aurora, and also the magnetic, the EM properties of the outer atmosphere of the planet from orbit. And that was kind of cool stuff, because the electron beam, when they fired it, you could actually see the beam. It would be a beam of electrons, but they would be illuminated, and they would form a corkscrew. And that was because they were following a magnetic field line. you know, from spacecraft. Yeah, it was kind of really
this
cool.
This is going way over my head. So were you like, you were working, your job was in Texas, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
They're sending you to Tokyo in 1985 to do this job.
It was a group of us, yes.
How excited were you?
I was thrilled. It was an adventure. It was kind of scary because, you know, it was like it was very high visibility and you didn't want to make mistakes. And also you were in a different culture and you didn't want to. Mm-hmm. There are things, certain behaviors that, you know, you had to, certain attitudes and things that you had to take under control because the Japanese had a different culture from ours.
Oh, they're totally mad.
No, they're pleasant. It's a very pleasant.
Oh, they're very polite. I know that. And, I don't mean to criticize them, but I've never been to Japan, so I've no right to criticize them. But but the thing is, my friend who goes to, he swears by Japan. He loves Japan. He goes there. He'd go there, you know, three times a year if he could. But COVID kind of stopped that. Mm-hmm. He said the beer was fantastic, and he said it's a misunderstanding that Japan is expensive because people always think Japan is a really expensive place. And he said you just need to be like the locals and know where to go, what to drink, mm-hmm. where to drink, mm-hmm. Where to get accommodation. But I presume you were paid for all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, we had a per diem compensation for all the food and activities. And it was interesting, riding the subway system. It was the first time in my life that I'd been inside a group, surrounded by, hundreds of thousands of people in a major city. Mm. And all of them, for a while, it was just this really strange experience that I was more or less completely all alone in this. But I didn't feel bad about it. And it was a very passive kind of culture. And I didn't have to. I saw things in Japan that I was shocked to see, like homeless people.
Really?
Oh, yes. In the subways. They did have a lost population around there. There are other things. I did take a day. I got on the subway and actually mastered the subway system in Tokyo and out to parts.
The real Tokyo, not the tourist Tokyo, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm. Well, I did also. When I grew up, I watched all the Toho monster movies, so I was very familiar with Godzilla and Mothra and. The Mysterians, the alien movies. I still watch those today. As a matter of fact, I just last week tuned in and watched the original Gojira, which was an interesting thing to watch if you want to see the in the context. But that's another story about it. But
you know, Thomas, I saw a documentary quite recently, actually, on Japanese people who are lonely, and it's interesting because I'm not sure of population of Tokyo, but I know it's big. And of course, compressed space, people have very small areas to live in because so many people in a small sort of area, city, big city, but lots of people probably barely fitting into that city. And it was a very interesting documentary because there was so many people who are so lonely, and it was very sad.
Mainly elderly people, as I understand.
No, they were all ages. They interviewed young people who were just, you know, they'd be on Facebook or whatever, Skype or whatever, but they were just lonely. And I'm just wondering, you know, why the culture, sort of why that was, you know.
Ah, gosh, I really wouldn't want to try to do an anthropological analysis of it. But
it's a very controlled environment, I think, and it is, to my opinion. Well, my opinion is that it's very conservative in many respects.
Mm-hmm, yes,
and Japanese can't just go mad all the time, you know, like we do in other developed countries. And I think that might be part of the reason as to why there's so much loneliness in these big cities.
Yes, it's. I have read the other thing about the fact that they're not having marriage, and their birth rate is way low.
Yes,
and it has to do a lot with alienation and isolation, and the fact that young couples can't get together and go out and, you know, fool around and have a good time and that kind of thing. They also, like we might be familiar, we had car culture. We, you know, whenever you wanted to go out on a date, you could pick a lady up in a car and drive out to a movie or something like that.
Like the 1950s drive-in movies.
Yeah, and all that. But I don't think they quite have a liberty. I'm maybe reaching out. I was there in 1985, and I don't know. I can't speak to what the culture's like in the present day. But I've read and heard things about severe problems with alienation and
It's exactly what this was about. This is what
housing issues, and they do live in a lot. When I was there, I was watching them build all these high rises, and I talked to a couple of them, and they had a nickname for because they would have these huge tall buildings with very tiny apartments, and they call them they referred to the buildings as rabbit warrens. It was just this massive construction thing to handle the then booming population, but now I hear it's things are kind of in reverse. And
and you know what, Japan has definitely a problem where, very similar to China actually, people are having less children, and the elderly population is booming, and this is because of, using the word booming, is because of the baby boomers after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. That was all going swimmingly well, but then now it's the opposite way. And all these people who were born, baby boomers like me and you, these people are getting old and depending on the system, you know?
Yes, there's another aspect of it too, and that was the corporate culture. I forget what they call the name of the people who work themselves to death. I saw a lot of them on subways too, drunk executives.
Yeah, they drink a lot and smoke a lot, didn't they?
Well, they were obligated. This is back in an earlier culture, that they, you know, their cubicle culture, but they tended to have to, if you wanted to stick with the organization, you had to spend, you know, your 12, 13 hours at work at your desk.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember the name that they had for the people who died at their desks. They would come in some...
Oh, my God.
But they also had a thing where they had to go out. They had to go out and socialize. So they had to hang out with the boss at a...
And they had to drink heavily.
And they had to do all that and then show up first thing in the morning the next day, which is... And that was... Now, this is an earlier era. This I cannot speak to what the society is like now, but...
I think it's the same.
They have the other thing that I heard was that the contract, the social contract between a corporation and the worker, and how basically if you swore your allegiance to a particular corporation, you would be employed for life, and you would have the at the end of it, you would have retirement benefits and all sorts of other things. But then apparently the world planetary wide economy was such that suddenly those contracts and covets, I'm trying to remember the name of the term for it, but the covenants that the corporations would have with their employees couldn't be, the companies couldn't afford them anymore. So as it is, I think that there isn't that committed corporate culture that used to exist.
I actually think it still exists to a certain extent. And then, of course, was the geisha girls.
Yes.
We were talking about, you know, these overworked young businessmen being forced to really drink alcohol at night after working 12-hour days and socialize with their bosses. As far as I understand, the geisha girls would be hired to be at the side of a businessman, and they'd be forced to drink as well. I knew one of these girls in the early 90s from Osaka, and she did this job in Sydney, and she said she doesn't drink, but she has to drink alcohol. It's full on, isn't it?
Yes, it was kind of a teen thing that you have to conform to their little clique. And the thing that I was most touched by, because I was young, much younger than 1985, and single and whatnot. But the one thing that the women did there that I loved the most was the elevator girls.
Oh, please do tell.
Oh, well, no, it's just that they would have these petite, sweet little ladies.
I've seen that in 60s movies.
Yeah, they run the elevators, and so you would go in and... arigato, please to you know, level number 13, and she, level number 13, hi, and then she would close the door. Hey. She would, and the thing that they had was, I mean, they had very sing-songy voices. They sounded almost like little, you know, little angels and stuff. But when you got to your floor, and she would open the elevator doors for her, and she would say arigato, and I would exit the door, and I would turn around and say, you know, thank you to her, and she would go. It was how gazinus for the morning, so be how gazinus and have a good day, and she would do it perfectly timed as the doors were closing.
Oh, very smart stuff! And of course, she would put her hands together and bow.
Well, they wouldn't bow, but, you know, she would just be, but, you know, it would be shallow bow, but with a smiley face.
Yeah, and that's a lovely thing.
I know. The elevator rides there were just really very pleasant for me when I was young, and they had these nice, attractive Japanese ladies who were running them.
How long were you there for?
It was 2 weeks.
All right, so did you have any romance going on?
No.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask.
I didn't want to get in trouble, and I kind of had to be there and hang there. And also the other thing is, you didn't just go out and ask a girl out for a date, because that was kind of contrary to the culture. And I didn't want to do it. It was just I was really worried about doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing and getting in trouble. So I had to stick to the
understandable because you're there for work.
Right, yes.
Just one more thing before we leave this subject. A friend of mine who I mentioned earlier on, he goes to Japan as much as he can, and he said it's so safe in Tokyo.
Oh, yes.
He likes to do photography. He's got mm-hmm. a big camera, and he takes lots of photos. Mm-hmm. And he bought his really high-quality Asahi beer, is it?
Yes, Asahi.
Asahi, pardon me, at a good price, and he wanted to go to the loo. So he left his camera on the table in the restaurant, went to the loo, and came back, and it was still there. This would not happen in your country or mine, Thomas Booker.
Right. Yes, and speaking of going to the loo, I also had to master the unusual toilets.
Oh, yeah, what's unusual?
You don't sit on them. You have to squat over them. I'm sure they've changed them out now. They have.
That will be changed for sure.
It was at the time.
Talking about toilets, here's another funny thing about the Japanese and how conservative they are. When they're going to the toilet, they have these little machines, and this is happening in the present day. They mm-hmm. buy these little machines that make noise, some kind of noise, so that you can't hear them going to the toilet.
Oh, yes, I think that's, another interesting. It's the other
bizarre.
Thing also was the public loos they have in the town, they were unisex. So
oh, really?
Yes, and they would have, you would go in, and it was no big deal, because they had to go, they were there to go to the restroom. And so it was no big deal. It's something that you did, so that they had men and women showing up in some of the places, and it was nothing, absolutely nothing threatening about it. Also had an old lady. Usually they would have a very old lady who would be the attendant. Mm-hmm. And so you'd be a guy who would be there standing at, doing your business, and along behind would come this old lady walking around you.
Really?
And you had to kind of get used to it. But once again, it was, they compartmentalize things to such a degree that, unlike what we have here in the United States now, the big controversy over LGBTQ access to restrooms. I think of the absurdity of the whole thing, because in other nations, as a matter of fact, I think France, some of them have unisex restrooms.
Well, you know what? It's so very Seinfeld, isn't it?
Yes.
They were ahead of the time, because, Seinfeld didn't get into that until the early 90s, the whole unisex thing.
You're a good friend around the planet on iTunes International.
If If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Thomas Booker in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas. And I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia for Bondi Tunes International. And now, for the last 10 minutes of this conversation, I'd like to talk about Elon Musk, who has he's blasted Trump, saying Constitution is greater than any president. You know, Thomas, what was it Trump said in the first place that got Elon a bit annoyed?
Well, it was basically Trump was building a logical argument based upon all of his lies. So he claims that it was fraud, widespread fraud, and the election was botched, and he was cheated out of it. And then he's making statements at this late point about how everything is so screwed up that they've completely botched the elections, what they need to do is just override the Constitution and allow him to take office again because he. And it's just this bizarre.
It's totally bizarre. And, you know, Elon Musk blasted this former President Trump because he called to terminate the Constitution over his unfounded claims of mass electoral fraud in the 2020 presidential election.
Yes.
And look, here's what happened, Thomas. He came back. He responded to Elon Musk's tweet and said, "I never said this. I never said, I never called to terminate the Constitution. Look, it's in print. He did." Uh-huh. Isn't that bizarre? Like, what's he doing, you know?
Well, I don't, okay, there are two personality disorders we're talking about. There are two pathological individuals here. We're talking about Trump and we're talking about Musk.
And they're both insane, really.
In the last 6 weeks, Musk has gone in and stomped all over he acquired Twitter for no apparent purpose and then has made the effort to completely wreck it. Mm. I never used Twitter, so I'm not feeling...
Neither do I. I've never had any interest in Twitter. It's just a gossip machine, you know?
But the trouble is that Twitter has become a tool for people in opposition movements, and it's been in use it's driven the uprisings in Myanmar and also in Iran and in numerous other places where they want to have a social uprising against a.
I think a good example is Iran, of course.
That woman
who was killed. Yeah.
Yes, and the thing is that the way that they coordinated the protests and the uprisings was through Twitter, alas. And here comes Musk, who he seems to have very shady affiliations with other powers that be.
Yeah.
He's sort of bought it, and then he's wrecking it, and running and destroying Twitter and throwing people off who are too radical. I mean, there are some controversies right now where he's actually throwing people off Twitter who were activists and also people who insulted him, people who made caricatures of him to tease him with using Twitter. Mm. And so he would he'd throw them off because he wouldn't allow people to misrepresent a personality on Twitter.
It's so erratic. His character is so erratic. And I just wonder what sort of game he's playing, and everyone's wondering. And you know, Adam Devlin, our political correspondent
here,
he has sort of said, well, he's got something going, you know, there's something going on. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that you know, even emergency services in America particularly use Twitter, and there was all this hoo-ha about you know, getting information, governmental warnings or whatever, and they depended on Twitter. And I thought that, you know, to me, Twitter is a gossip machine. Surely there's another way for, you know, emergency services to get hold of people.
Well, yeah, and that is to create another complete service, which is a public service channel for, you know, people can subscribe to it and get official information. You know, it has to be a government or have to be a government agency that would supervise it and hold strict to it. But then, yeah, in the case of national emergencies or crises or things like that, that you could go to it to get unfettered information from a government. That would be I'm surprised that there isn't a service there. There may be that I don't know.
I'm sure there is. There must be. Older people, many, many, many older people are not on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it is because when I go on Facebook, and I, of course, if you noticed, I tend to be kicked off of Facebook every now and then.
Oh, don't we all?
But I basically like to go on there and have a conversation, and that's the beauty of Facebook, is that you can exchange ideas and you can have a discussion with someone, and somebody can tell you that you're full of it, and you can look it up and say, I might be. And
Thomas, the thing is that it's not humans restricting your access or putting you in Facebook jail.
It's
a bot. Yeah, yes. And you know, they just pick these bots. They pick up words, these algorithms.
Yep.
And then you're suddenly in Facebook jail when it's a lot of the time it's rubbish. Like, it's ridiculous, you know?
Yep. Been there. Matter of fact, I did at one point, I happened to stumble across a real live monitor, and I talked to somebody at Facebook and said, "Do you realize you've screwed up? You've totally misinterpreted everything I was saying here. Your algorithm is screwed up." And he looked at it and said, "Oh, okay, sorry." And he let me back.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was an unusual. That was, I don't know how that came to happen, but there was a point where you could actually talk to a live human being briefly. So it must be somebody who came into the office in the afternoon to check something and just happened to be there. But
Musk seems to think that Twitter has a lot of left-wing stuff going on before he bought it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, everything that I'm seeing about Musk that makes him really dangerous is he seems to be embracing authoritarianism. And I don't know if a lot of it has to do with his background as growing up privileged in South Africa. And assuming the racist and authoritarian attitudes that used to come from apartheid,
especially with the Afrikaans,
and the apartheid era. And
I'm guessing he was an Afrikaan.
Afrikaan, yes.
I'm just saying it with the accent.
Afrikaan,
I don't know. He sounds like he is.
He does have the accent it's a weird, it's an English Dutch accent.
Yeah, isn't that weird? I've always found that weird because I lived in Holland for a year. And, you know, when I heard the South African accent, I thought, that's weird. That must be historical in some way. There must be, maybe the Dutch took over South Africa or something. I don't know.
You have to go back there. It was a British colony, but it was also settled by the Dutch, who were there. I think they were kind of a religious branch. But I don't know if you recall around 1897 or something like that, a thing called the Boer War. The Boers were the Dutch settlers.
Michael Caine did the movie.
Yes,
about the Boer War. That's how I know.
Remember when Winston Churchill was captured and he managed to find a way to escape and became famous and made his name.
I didn't know that.
He was supposedly a correspondent there, but he also carried a pistol, and he was really humming along. But he was captured and put in a detention facility, and his big thing was he managed to make there was a plan to escape from it, and he sort of appropriated all the plans and carried them out on his own without coordinating with the people who were planning the escape.
Wow.
And he managed to make it out and hide out. I think he hid out in a gold mine that happened to be run by English settlers who were sympathetic with him, who then managed to smuggle him out on a train and had them to make it all the way out of South Africa. And I forget to a neutral African country where he could then get out and return to England.
I did not know that at all.
That made him famous, and that was one of the things that catapulted into having a career in Parliament.
Wow, and the rest is history, as they say.
The rest is history.
Yeah. Okay, Thomas, we have got to go. It's always very educational talking to you. Look, thank you for joining us here on the show.
It was a pleasure. It's been a while. It's just nice to have a good conversation with you, Henry, and I appreciate that.
Indeed. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. From Leicester, the United Kingdom, Ling Pang on Bondi
Tunes International. Hi, This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Zoe Anderton. Zoe was born in Wales, beginning harp lessons in primary school, continuing her studies at the Royal College of Music and Drama. Welcome, Zoe. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I understand you studied music and taught music professionally. Now you are freelancing.
Yes, I am trained as a music teacher for high school, and I taught in Swansea and then moved on to Norwich and then later to Nottingham. Then when I had my children, then I decided to take a break from teaching and freelance on the harp. So that's what I've done for the last 4 or 5 years now.
So your music interest started in Wales?
Yes. So the Welsh culture means that harp is a big part of our celebrations, Eisteddfods, which are like cultural events. And it's very common to have harp teachers. And they're always in Welsh-speaking schools. There's always a peripatetic harp teacher. So because I attended a Welsh-speaking school, I got the chance to audition to play the harp. And you had to be able to play the piano. Basically, you had to be able to read music as a prerequisite, which I did. So I was able to then get through the audition, and I've been playing ever since.
Musically, your journey started in Wales. And since then, you have moved to a different part of UK, and subsequently, you did music training. You already can play the piano. So from there, to play a different instrument, a harp instrument, did that come easy for you?
I think because the layout of the harp is the same in terms of on a piano, you've got C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C. On the harp, it's the same, but obviously instead of striking the notes on the piano, you are plucking the strings. Mm. So you, it's the same order. So it is a quite a technique to grasp. But if you do play the piano, I think it's not such a huge jump.
How do you do the sharp and the flat on the harp?
So typically you start on a little Celtic harp, and that has levers, which changes the key. Eventually, as you get more competent on the harp, you're going to get more accidentals, more key changes, which means then you can't be moving your hands with the levers as well as playing. So then you move on to a pedal harp, which has got 7 pedals, which you use your feet to move. So if it's in the middle, then that's natural. If you flick it up, it's a flat. And if you push it down, it's sharp. So it's just it becomes sort of muscle memory after a while.
How many musical instruments that you play besides piano and the harp?
Well, I had to learn the basics of guitar so that I could teach it to high school students. But to be fair, they were usually better than me by the end of the course. But so I can sort of play chords by reading them, but I'm not proficient. I did on the violin, but that never went anywhere. So. But it was piano and harp that really stuck for me.
What is your aim to achieve? You are now freelancing. Have you performed in venues and concerts?
Yeah, so in the past, I've played for orchestras. So as a teenager, I played with the Welsh National Youth Orchestra. And then when I was at university, I played with the Halle Youth Orchestra, which is in Manchester. And now, because I'm freelancing, you will get booked as a one-off concert as a harpist, because obviously they don't have a harp in every orchestral piece, so they usually will book in a harpist. It's only the big orchestras that have a salaried harpist. The rest are just sort of booked in. But I tend to do lots of weddings these days. I also play monthly at a hotel not too far from me in Aldborough. So it's taken me to some beautiful places, like favourite places, Holcombe Hall. Love playing there. I play for their Christmas tours. I've played in Norwich Castle for their Children in Need. That was broadcast on BBC television. It's just taken me to some beautiful places. Just really love the opportunities it gives me.
Would you like to perform abroad as well? Because you've got a family, you've got children.
Yeah, I mean, that would be lovely to do in the future. It's just having the opportunity, I guess, to, you know, I always take all the opportunities that I'm given, because my passion is the harp. So whenever I'm offered work, I accept it if I can.
How do you manage to move a harp instrument around with you when you go places?
So it's got a dust cover just when it's at home, and then you put on a sort of a more heavy duty cover, and then it obviously doesn't come apart. So you just lay it flat in an estate car. So I've got a trolley that I put it on, and then I can sort of push it around and drag it around. And I can do it myself. Easier with two people, but I've got this sort of mattress that I lie on the back of the estate, and it just lies on like a bed. So it's not as difficult as you would think, but it's hopefully, it's a lot of effort to sort of obviously get it in and out, but it's there to be used, it's there to be performed.
So how many pieces do you usually perform in one gig for a wedding?
So yeah, I don't usually keep track, but once I was asked to play 10 songs before the bride came in, and that added up to about 30 minutes. So so usually at a wedding, I'll play, so say 10 songs before the bride comes in, then play as she walks down the aisle, play for the sign in the register, then play as she and the groom exit, and then as the guests leave. So that will be one. So that will be maybe 15 pieces. If it's like a background drinks reception, you're probably looking 25 to 30.
Incredible. How long have you been freelancing, Zoe?
4 years.
4 years. You have got an agent to do the booking for you?
No, I just do it myself. Usually I have three agencies that I work with, but also people contact me directly. I just do it myself.
You're a very organized lady.
Yeah.
I understand that you have been raising funds for the motor neuron disease, and that's support people living with MND. What is the important cause for you to support?
Yeah, so when I was teaching at Norwich, at a school called City Norwich School, one of the music teachers, he worked for the county. His name was David O'Neill. And he was quite a character. He was quite unique. So you would definitely remember him if you ever met him. And towards the end of my time in Norwich, he sent an email to all of us staff to say that he'd just been diagnosed with this illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him and just to say I was really sorry to hear about his diagnosis, because it's an awful diagnosis to have, because there's not much treatment out there. It's pretty gloomy news as it stands. He didn't live for too much longer. Can't remember, maybe a year, 18 months.
Mm.
And so since then, even before he passed away, I started to do some busking. And when I found out he had motor neurons, I busked for motor neurons in Norwich City Centre, and he was really touched. And after he passed away, I continued to do busking, like on the seafront in like Marks and Spencers, in co-ops that were local to me. So when I released my first CD, I gave the 25% of the proceeds to motor neurons. And then as soon as I sort of covered all my costs, then all of the money went to motor neurons. So with this latest one, I wanted to do it again for motor neurons, just because research is going on for the charity, and it is actually looking really promising if the breakthrough they've had actually works. Because before that, it's just been sort of slowing down the inevitable rather than being able to reverse the effects. So all the research obviously relies on money, so that's why I support that charity.
You talked about an album. Did you write some of the pieces yourself, Zoe?
I actually do write music, but for my CDs, I've had three CDs that I've brought out. Two of them are sort of pop music, and one is a Christmas album. So I just think that the market just would, I just don't think I would have the interest for my own compositions. I put them up on my Facebook page, but in terms of CD sales, I tend to stick to things that I know that will sell. So I write little lullabies, which I really enjoy. But the albums themselves are popular music. Mm. Also, yeah, I've done another composition of my own, and I've linked up with an Italian network of harpists, and we've sort of recorded our pieces, and there's like been lots of harpists all collaborating together, and then it kind of culminates in a video performance. So that's been quite fun, just to kind of keep yourself sort of with a project. I always like to have something that I am preparing for.
That sounds exciting for you. Harp is the sort of music that we don't get to experience every day, because there are many harpists around.
Yeah, it's not a very common instrument for people to play, just because the cost of buying one. I think it's the financial side of it that is obviously a big one, but also the accessibility of having a teacher. It tends to be something, especially living in England, it tends to be something that's really only available in private schools, whereas in Wales it's in any Welsh speaking school, so it's a lot more accessible in Wales. So I think it's just like having access to those opportunities is the problem that people have over here.
Do you go back to Wales often to see your family and relatives?
Yeah, usually every 2 to 3 months. And I still have sort of links to some performing there as well.
You sent in 3 pieces of music. Would you like to introduce it and tell us why you want to play this piece?
Yeah, so I during the lockdown, the pandemic, I actually recorded an album. And one of the pieces is a song called Fix You. It's by Coldplay. And I've always loved this song because firstly, because it's got an organ in the introduction in the original. I just think that's really inventive that they've managed to find like an organ sound. And I just think it really resonates with lots of people, because obviously it's about grief. It's about loss.
It is.
And,
yeah.
But it has sort of an uplifting finish. So it has a sort of a triumphant feel towards the end. So it's not all doom and gloom. But it's a really enjoyable song to play on the harp.
And the website to get your music and future gigs.
Yeah, so if people want to find out about performances or buy the CD, so they go to Zoe Anderton, so anderton.co.uk, or go to my Facebook page is Zoe Anderton Harpist, or my Instagram page is also Zoe Anderton Harpist.
Zoe, I wish you all the very best.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Zoe Anderton.
You're a good friend around the planet, Bondi Tunes International.
I'd like to stay in love with you all summer and after fall.
Sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.